Welcome to Earth Matters, a weekly show that discusses environmental and conservation issues that affect us here in Grant County, around New Mexico, nationally, and globally. This is Allison Civic, Executive Director of Gila Resources Information Project, and I'm your host for today's program. The Gila Resources Information Project, also known as GRIP, is a nonprofit environmental organization that works to promote community health by protecting our environment and natural resources here in southwestern New Mexico. Today, we'll be talking about community-supported agriculture, otherwise referred to as CSA. CSAs are an alternative, locally-based economic model of agriculture and food distribution. And we have a couple of CSAs here in Grant County, and with us today to talk more about this idea is Doug Smith of Townside Farm, located on Little Walnut Road in Silver City. And we'll also learn more about Townside Farm's operations. Good afternoon, Doug.
Good afternoon. How are you today?
Good. Thanks for being here on Earth Matters. And let's start out. Can you tell our listeners what is a CSA? Tell us a little bit more about CSAs and how they work and what they're all about.
As you said, CSA stands for Community Supported Agriculture. Essentially, what it is somewhat like a subscription service that essentially a client pays ahead of time or in an installment basis and is able to receive essentially a season's worth of food. Our season consists of 20 weeks from June 1st through October 15th. You get a sampling of what's available that week from the farm. We have varying degrees of, we grow about 75 different types of vegetables, or different varieties, about three or four different types of each variety. And so that way we give our clients a good selection as well as variety so that they're not getting, say, the same bunch of collard greens every week. And essentially what this is a way of, in the consumer's end, it's a way of receiving fresh, seasonal, local produce on a weekly basis that has just been picked within a few days and direct to consumer. And then in the farmer's end, it benefits them by alleviating overhead costs in the beginning of the season when they are the highest. For a farmer, usually only makes his revenue when he actually sells the vegetables, but alas, you need to plant the vegetables and make the farm and everything first, and that usually takes quite a bit of overhead in the early part of the year when there's usually not that much available. So that helps clear the overhead, and in my case was able to purchase seeds, purchase our frost protection and drip tape, our irrigation lines, things like that, and setting aside things for, say, apprentice pay and general just bills, insurance, things like that come up in the beginning of the season. And so that helps us cover those costs initially, as well as really investing in the local economy, because the residents of the community is able to know that their money stays in the community for the most part. And it really benefits the total economy as well.
Right. So it's really a way to help sort of manage the risk, right, to the farmer?
Absolutely. Yes. And also it's a measure of having the consumer be more aware of the inherent risks that are in farming. By making the upfront investment, it really is an investment. It's something where you're not quite sure as a consumer that risk of, say, a hailstorm or an insect infestation or some sort of natural happening that might prevent the crops from coming up or, you know, prevent their growth. And a lot of times the farmer has to deal with that in and of themselves in a loss of revenue, and which can be rather detrimental because of the fine line of overhead that is with the farm. And so it's something that can help alleviate a lot of that pressure.
Right.
Yeah.
And there really isn't that much food being grown here locally, right? Food for people as opposed to food for cows. I mean, seems like Townside Farm and what's the other CSA? There are a couple other
Frisco Farms.
Frisco Farms, that's right. So I think you two are the only CSAs here locally, is that right?
That I know of, yeah.
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 So you're really providing a source, right, for people to get locally grown food, because there really doesn't seem to be all that much.
Yeah, I would say Kyle, the man who runs Frisco Farms, him and I are probably the two larger producers in the county, which Doesn't say much because we're about probably about 5 acres if you put us both together. But there are other food producers. There seems to be less every year. The average age of farmers in New Mexico is 57, and that obviously goes up every year. And so even in the past 3 years at the farmers market, I've noticed a decline in the older generation of farmers in the county. Mm-hmm. As far as coming and vending and such. And some folks just either are have done it long enough and are ready to retire, and other folks, I know, you know, some folks who just basically are ready to retire, but there's a lacking of folks coming up to take up the reins. Right. And that's where the hazard can occur, of where you have, you know, farms that are turned into developments essentially, or sold off in parcels, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. And that could be an issue. But on the positive side, there is an increase in the younger generation of farmers, you know, the average age of, you know, in their 30s or so, that are actually coming in, and new farmers that are opening new operations. And actually the most of that population is females, according to statistics and such, that most new farmers are female.
And that's nationally? Farmers nationally?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so let's talk a little bit more about how Townside operates specifically. So you had, I think you were telling me, you've got 25 shares of CSA that people can buy into. That's
yes.
not really the right way to say it, but tell us exactly kind of how it works. And
well, it's a lot of logistics and a lot of spreadsheets in the winter that basically allowed me to figure out how much food I've produced the year before, and therefore how to estimate how much I will produce the next year. And then I basically divide that in thirds, where I have a third of that produce goes to our CSA, a third of that produce goes to the farmers market, and a third of that goes to our local co-op and local restaurants. And so that way I can plan accordingly, so that I don't necessarily, if I had the whole farm under a CSA, that can be rather hazardous in the aspect of, you know, realizing that if there were any detrimental things that happen, you know, it's something as well with the reputation of the farm and things. And also, it's just nice. I really enjoy working with area restaurants. I really enjoy working with at the face-to-face of the farmer's market. And as well, we have our pickup options for the CSAs. You can pick up on the farm on Tuesday evenings, or you can pick up at the farmer's market on Saturday. And so that's another nice thing as well, is that not only can you come and pick up your share, but you can also, you know, socialize and pick up any other things you might need at the market.
And what sorts of things are you growing? I know it's obviously varying by season, but early on, greens?
Yep, we have our lettuce mix, our salad mix, which is a mixture of quite a few different types of lettuce and mesclun greens, which are our bitter greens, usually consisting of mustards, kales, your hearty greens, things like that. And then we also do brassicas, which are roots, or a lot of your broccolis, cabbages, kales, radishes, things like that, cool weather crops. And then for the summer season, we have our tomatoes, peppers, onions, beans. Our melons are quite popular, watermelons, honeydews, cantaloupes, things like that. I try to grow as much variety as I can. Number one, just to keep people interested and myself interested. Number two, that way to kind of hedge your bets that if one variety doesn't do so well, you have a backup of other types.
And are you growing any heirloom crops that maybe are adapted to this area?
Yeah, I try to grow. Everything that we grow is either sourced from organic seed, or we grow organically. We're not certified organic, but we do not use any sort of chemical pesticides or anything like that. And everything that I look for is for dry, high elevation, or cold climates, actually, because of the bookend of our short growing season is very cold. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of times, like for example, our almond trees that we have growing are from Canada and are able to withstand a hard frost. And so we're able to grow an almond tree at our farm. The fruit trees that we have are also from Canada as well, because they can withstand a late frost, that cold late season. Otherwise, a lot of our veg is mostly like a drought tolerant or full sun type of crop. We do protect a lot of our stuff with shade cloth as well, and frost cover during the winter and such, to try to extend our season some.
All right. And was Townside always run as a CSA?
No, this is actually only our second year. We've been in operation this is our fifth season so far.
Okay.
And it was just something that came along. I was trained on a CSA as my apprenticeship on a farm back east was a CSA farm, as well as markets and such. And it was just really inspiring to see the community benefit as well as, you know, in meeting people and how many people really would benefit locally from that venture, but also the economics of it just make total sense from a producer standpoint, as well as from a consumer, just as far as having that initial overhead. If I hadn't had the CSA this year, I'm not sure I'd be running the farm the way I am this year, actually.
Okay.
So it's essential at this point.
It's essential.
Yeah.
Just having that upfront.
Right.
Cash investment.
And, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So you mentioned you apprenticed back east on a farm. How did you get into farming?
I grew up in a rather rural community. It's sort of, I grew up in Connecticut. It's sort of where the city, specifically where I'm from, is where the city meets the trees. And so it's something where there's a lot of, the county that I'm from was some of the last farmland in the state. And so it's very well protected. And it's because of the population density and economic stability of there, it does quite well. And so I think the growth rate for organic produce is something like between 10 and 20% over the last decade. And so it was coincidence that I found the farm back there, actually. I was looking for something that actually paid a decent wage, and it happened to be in my hometown, of all places. And I looked all over the country, and it was literally, that was the best fit as far as what I was looking for. And it was great. It was a 375-member CSA on a 20-acre organic farm, certified organic. So I got to learn more about that and the certification process, the paperwork, the scheduling, things like that. And also the seasonality of not just monocropping or planting one thing and waiting, but we were planting something different almost every day of the year. I mean, really, it was every day we were planting something, either seeding something or planting in the field to keep that rotation going. So that was a big lesson for me. And Paul, the gentleman who owned the place, was extremely knowledgeable. And I'm extremely grateful and can't believe how much I benefited from his knowledge.
Mm, great. Where was that in Connecticut?
In New Milford, Connecticut.
Oh, all right. Yep.
My hometown.
Great. We'll be right back after this short break. Welcome back to Earth Matters. We're here today with our guest, Doug Smith of Townside Farm, discussing community-supported agriculture. And CSAs generally focus on the production of high-quality foods for a local community, often using organic or biodynamic farming methods. I know you mentioned earlier that Townside Farm is organic, not certified, but you are following organic practices. Maybe you could tell us a little bit more about what your organic practices are.
Sure. Essentially, as I said before, I was trained on an organic farm, so that it was much easier to enter that realm. And idealistically, personally, it just makes sense. And it was great, the education aspect of the farm back east, because the owner of the farm was actually, he worked in a chemistry lab. He was an organic chemist beforehand. And so he actually gave us quite a bit of the science behind, say, how legumes produce nitrogen in the soil and things like that. And we would go through to other farms and learn about how they operate and their methods and things. And so, and plus I'm an input junkie. I read constantly. I'm constantly doing research on new methods, new technology, and what's coming up and how to be more efficient at the farm in a lot of ways. And so growing organic, I mean, it's something that we use very little. We basically tend to use four items. We use a fish emulsion, and that provides nitrogen. We use a sea kelp, and that provides our phosphorus and our potassium to the plants. And we also use a neem oil, which is our pesticide. It's an organic, made from the oil of a neem tree. And that is it's not like a Roundup where it'll kill something instantly. It actually works over time. It's something you have to apply over and over and over again, but, it's something that works and it doesn't harm the plants. You know, it won't harm the people that eat the plants either. All of these things are found in nature and they are, organic, and you actually have to reapply them because they'll wash off, essentially from the water. But it's something with those three combinations, it really is effective, especially in times like this where stress is a big factor on the plants. And that's exactly what can cause plants to, when you see, you know, aphids or insects, and the way that insects know what plants to attack is the same way that germs know how to attack your body, is that when your immune system is down, when your body is stressed, it invites pestilence, into your system. Mm-hmm. And so it's the same thing with plants. They give off vibes, or literally hormones, that trigger different types of insects to come and say, hey, you know, I'm a meal, come get me. And so a lot of times what we do, because we have pretty much every insect you can think of, as far as a pest is concerned, on the farm, we try to, if we keep the plants healthy, the pests don't matter. They actually, you'll see, you know, all, they'll be hanging out on the plants but not eating them, because they're healthy enough and they're vibrant. And with that vibrancy comes the, how do you say, it's not attractive to the mm-hmm. bugs. And so a lot of times they might find one plant and go after that. And so a lot of times I'll just let them have it. If they keep off the other right. plants, I can let that one go. And if that plant becomes overpopulated or anything, I just rip it out and throw it in the compost, and I don't really have to worry about it too much. And so that's our three biggest methods, and weeding. I do a lot of hand weeding. We're about, if you put all of the fields together, we're about an acre and a quarter of row crops that we grow. And then we also have an orchard, a 20-tree fruit orchard, as well as a few hundred bramble plants, blackberries and raspberries. And so the whole farm itself is about 2 acres. All of it is cultivated by hand. I was weeding this morning, just by hand or with a hoe. And that's another thing where we also have volunteers come during the year to help with a lot of that work. We also have an apprenticeship program, where basically I have a full-time apprentice. We've been worked with people from all over the country so far. We've had an apprentice for about 3 years now, or rather this is our third year of an apprentice. And I do have full-time help coming at the end of the month, and that'll be for the rest of the season, as well as I have a volunteer for vegetables program, where if you're a member of the community and want to come get your hands dirty or even just help wash our veg, I take anyone of any skill level I feel can always help in some way at the farm. It's not always backbreaking work. A lot of it is, but it's not always that way. We do spend some time in the shade, especially when we're washing the vegetables and things like that. We have a small cooler, 6x8 walk-in cooler that we fit everything into, and that's kind of part of the reason why I say that how the magic happens is that we can actually preserve our veg in a state that's best for the veg. So we're not, you know, having stuff wilt, and we don't have to worry about if we pick it that day, do we have to sell it that day? And so when you get your veg, it's in its peak, and it can last for quite a while.
Hmm. So just a couple more questions I have on the fish emulsion and sea kelp. Mm-hmm. Do those get sprayed on, or?
We actually buy them. You can find them in the stores around here, usually in bottles, like in a liquid form.
Okay.
But it's most economical in bulk to buy it. We buy it as a dry powder. And then you literally just add a tablespoon or so to it, to per gallon of water. Same thing with the sea kelp. We'll add about a teaspoon or so per gallon of water. And I have a 4-gallon backpack sprayer that I put on and feel like a spaceman when I walk around the farm. And we do foliar feeding, which is basically it's a small misting spray that is applied to the underside of the leaves. And so that way the plants can take it up. And it's more effective than, say, fertilizing the earth or spraying the earth, because very little of that will actually reach the plant roots. And so if I was to, say, use a powdered fertilizer on the ground, on the average, about 10% of that will actually get to the plant.
Interesting.
The rest of it will end up in the soil, which will benefit the soil, but ultimately you want to benefit the plants. And whereas by spraying, about 80% of what's actually sprayed on the plant is actually taken up. Some of it might evaporate or whatnot, but it's much more effective and it's almost instantaneous. I mean, I've sprayed at night and the next day I'll come out and the plants are, you know, very upright. They'll actually change to a darker green color. They start producing much more nitrogen. And the sea kelp is really what helps. It's very good for cellular structure. In other words, we can get really nice, thick, leafy greens, our romaine heads. We can get 3 to 5 pound heads of romaine, you know, and it's all through that. It's by giving them this extra punch of vitamins.
Interesting. Yeah. Huh. I guess I didn't realize you could do that foliar spraying and that was actually more effective. That's pretty neat.
Yeah, it's extremely effective. It's probably my main method of fertilizing, basically, purely because of it just works so quickly. And the plants love it.
Right, yeah. Right. And so what about, how do you irrigate? And we were talking earlier about how this time of year, given the lack of rain, is so difficult to do farming here. And so how are you keeping those poor little guys alive out in the fields?
Well, we do have we are well irrigated. We do have a well drilled on the property, and then we have that. We use cover crop during the off season to protect our fields, and we use an overhead sprinkler irrigation for that. And then during the planting season, I'll use the overhead irrigation to pop the seeds to get them to come out of the ground to actually germinate, because the seeds are just below the surface of the ground. But then during the year, we use what's called drip tape or drip irrigation. It's a little different than a soaker hose. A soaker hose is sort of like a sponge that emits the water out of the whole surface area of the hose, whereas drip tape is something where it literally will drip the water out of this black plastic hose that we bury under the ground at fixed intervals. So it'll be, you can buy it at all sorts of intervals. Ours are about 8 inches apart. And then we put two lines of T-tape down the bed, and that covers essentially, our beds are about 3 feet wide. We put our T-tape about a foot apart, and that way it'll cover pretty much the entire bed with the coverage that comes out of that water or comes out of the T-tape. And what that does is there's been many studies done, actually at NMSU is a few of the better ones, about the efficiency level, how many gallons per acre you use using drip irrigation versus flood, which is another very popular method around here for irrigation. And in some crops, it does have its merits, but in most, it's far more efficient, especially in an evaporative sense, to water underground. Essentially as well, because in anything, you want to water the roots of the plant, not the plant itself. And especially here with how much sun we get and the mineralized content of our water, if I was to water all of our plants overhead, you'd start seeing spots. You know, and cosmetically speaking, it's not always good, but also as well, those spots can end up burning the plant if that water sets on the plant for too long, that kind of thing, if I use a sprinkler exclusively. But evaporation is our biggest thing here as far as, you know, I mean, water conservation is our biggest issue as of late. And so, you know, I mean, every year we get a little less out of our well, you know, and it, some years are better than others, but you know, this year has been tough. And so, but we just try to adjust with anything in farming. It's all about adjusting, and seeing what we can do. But the T-tape is definitely our biggest ally as far as the watering is concerned. Especially once everything gets started, and we do use raised beds. And so that helps, the soil is loose. It aids in what's called the capillary action of the watering, so that the water can actually travel upward through the beds and to the roots of the plants, using the spaces that's left between all the particulate matter in the beds and such. And the combination of overhead watering with underneath can really saturate the beds, especially early in the season when it needs it. I do a lot of my watering at night, which in most places is taboo, simply because of concerns with condensation, mold, humidity, things like that. But that's not so much something we have to worry about here. And again, with that lack of evaporation factor at night is huge. I can have a bed, you know, remain wet almost twice as long if I water at night with the T-tape versus if I'm watering during the day because of the heat, mostly. Yeah.
And what about salt? Do you have salt buildup with the drip tape at all?
We can have mineralization. It's more common if you we do bury our T-tape, and okay. So it's more common with tape that is laid on top, which is another popular way. It's a little easier to deal with in the installation sense. It becomes a little bit more of a pain when you go to cultivate and weed as far as moving the hoses back and forth. I'm sorry, could you repeat the question?
Do you have issues with salt mineralization?
Not so much, because we do have filters. We have we have a filter in our greenhouse for that irrigation, and it's sort of a secondary filter to the one that's actually up at our pump house that, you know, this time of year especially gets cleaned out quite often.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So you're filtering the water before?
A little bit. Yeah. It's a micron filter is what it's called. It's right. Not like a Brita or anything, but it is something that will filter a lot of that larger calcium deposits, especially out of it.
Interesting. So it sounds like a lot of work. Yep. Doug, a lot of work. So, and you mentioned you had an apprentice, but so how many people does it take to farm Townside Farm?
Well, I'm the only full-time person. I'm the you know, I'm there all year, 365, 7 days a week. People often ask me if I get a day off, and I often ask them,
What's that?
Well, not only what do you construe as a day off, right? You know, I mean, there's always watering to be done. The greenhouse always has to be opened. You know, I care for thousands of little lives every day. But it's, again, it's a labor of love. It's something that's, it's just comes with the territory. I like to consider farming a lifestyle, not a career. It's not a job. It's a way of life, you know. And so it's something that I really enjoy. But then when, you know, this time of year when the weeds start coming in and the harvesting begins is when I do – I have, a full-time apprentice that I come on – or comes on about this time of year. I've had a couple of students that have come up from NMSU, another one from Iowa last year, and a few other folks from Albuquerque last year that came down that sort of split the season in half. A lot of times I work with schools as well. The university, you know, the usual college summer is usually about the middle of May to about the middle of August, and which is our great peak season. And then as well to supplement that, an additional help, we have our volunteer for vegetables program. And on the average, I have about 2 to 3 people there every day. So on the average, there's probably about between 4 and 5 of us there during the real bulk of the season, the peak of the season, at least halfway through the day. I usually have our volunteers come and help us harvest from about 8 in the morning till noon. And then the afternoon is usually spent doing weeding, chores, things like that.
Wow. Lots of work. Well, we'll be right back after this break and continue our interview with Doug Smith of Townside Farm. Welcome back to Earth Matters. We're here today with our guest, Doug Smith of Townside Farm, discussing community-supported agriculture. So, Doug, give us a sense of the operations of the farm over the course of the year. I know it's got to take a lot of planning, and you're not just sitting back twiddling your thumbs during the winter. I'm sure you're still very busy during the winter. So what does your job look like over the course of the year?
Well, actually, we have been harvesting growing continuously and harvesting continuously 365 days a year for the last 2 years. And that is possible through our what I like to call our winter greenhouse. What that entails is come the end of the particular season of the outdoor or of the field crops, when that stuff starts coming in about the end of October and we're ready to start planting our cover crop and finishing the season outside, I really was looking for a way to create revenue on either end of the season, given that we have a lot of sunshine, but still a relatively short growing season, being about 4 months of harvest. So we did a lot of research, and we found a greenhouse and a growing method that can really help us extend our growing season full year, as well as obviously our revenue and providing, you know, tasty food to the community as well. During the winter, we have it's about 1,000 square foot greenhouse. It's a 50 by 20, and we have solar hot water radiant floor heat in the greenhouse. So instead of growing normal green, a lot of greenhouses either uses benches and grows on a bench that's elevated off the ground, or uses just grows right in the earth inside the greenhouse. Both of those methods require a heat source, especially during the winter. And virtually anywhere in the country, you'd need a heat source of some sort to get completely through the winter, especially through the low light periods and such. And it's something that I've always, in many of my training back east, you know, we'd go visit other greenhouses and I'd see these gigantic oil-fired furnaces sitting in the corner of the greenhouse with all these, you know, ducts coming out of it, just like your house. But it's not an airtight structure by any means. You know, while you can roll the windows down and roll the sides down to the greenhouse and seal it up as best you can, when the wind blows, you can feel the air blowing right through it. And so as far as, again, in the name of efficiency and also just cost effectiveness, I saw that as a major hurdle and something that could, especially given all of our sun that we have here, be remedied somehow. And in doing a lot of my research, I found a company that makes solar hot water bench covers. They're like essentially this cover that's filled with water that is attached to a solar hot water panel, and this water flows through and everything. And I thought about it as, well, why can't I do the same thing without the bench? Again, without that extra infrastructure, if you will. It was a decent investment up front, but it'll pay for itself within the first 5 years, I think, as far as the actual extra investment of the greenhouse and the what it would take to install the radiant floor heat and everything. So we have two solar hot water panels, which are essentially large solar panels. They're large glass sheets that have copper tubing running underneath them that are painted black, and water heats as it flows through that tubing, and just through conductive energy flows through. And we also have a pump, solar DC pump as well. The greenhouse is entirely passive. So there's a small pump that turns on when the sun comes up and turns off when the sun goes down. And so this fluid that flows through these panels goes into our floor and runs up and down the length of the floor underneath bins. They're actually, we use currently masonry bins. Essentially, I'll probably end up building something that'll last a little longer. Right now they're plastic, but it's something that works essentially for now. But eventually I will be building a more stable and substantial bed system in there. But essentially what it is it's something that the radiant floor tubing underneath the floor is able to keep the soil that sits directly on top of that floor in the container warm, or actually more accurately, the water in the soil warm. And that in turn, again, keeps the roots of the plant warm. And because that water is flowing through the plant, just as if you were to drink hot tea on a cold day and you can literally feel it flowing through you or flowing, you know, it's the same concept. It's something that keeps the plants warm. The lowest temperature I've recorded thus far is about 16 degrees inside the greenhouse. I do use frost cloth to cover our beds as well during the winter. And our frost cloth was literally frozen. Solid, like a sheet, like of cardboard. And I pulled it off our beds, and the greens were perfectly happy and perfectly fine underneath it. The soil temperature is about 50 degrees during the winter with that radiant floor heat all year.
And so is all that produce going to, say, the co-op or?
Yep, I split that between the co-op and a local restaurant in town.
Okay.
And I get about 20 pounds a week. And that's, I only harvest, I have three beds per se in the greenhouse, and I only harvest one bed at a time. And so I'm able to keep a rotation going. And so by the time I come back to one bed, it's been about a week and a half, and it's been able to come back and really grow. So that way I'm not cutting too much and therefore stressing out the plants. I'm giving them enough time to really recover and then coming back and cutting them again. And, I would, you know, deliver about twice a week, one to one place, one to the other. And on the average, about 10 to 12 pounds of harvest. So that's it's our best year so far as that's
amazing.
Concerned.
Wow.
And then that's really what gets us through the winter with revenue, a little added extra revenue, as well as just providing fresh greens for the community. I mean, it's demand is so high, especially on the retail level, that by the time I deliver it, it's usually gone within a couple of hours. And that's, I like that, you know, and I give them more every time, and it still, you know, continues to go.
Right.
So that's the greens and the melons are probably our most popular items, as well as our biggest moneymaker, actually. So it works really well. It's something that greens is, it's funny, as it's such a tender crop, they do grow so well here. They really like the soil and the water as well. And so it's just something that I love to grow it as well, just because it's tasty. But that's what really gets us through the winter. And then like right now I'm in a transition period where I'll be switching over the greenhouse to hot weather crops. It's becoming too hot in the greenhouse during the day and the greens will start to bolt or grow too quickly and they put out their seeds. So in that case, instead of just putting more greens and having them do that again, I switch over to some summer crops being, I kind of alternate. I'm still kind of experimenting of what will do the best. This year I'm doing sweet peppers and eggplants in the greenhouse. I've done tomatoes, peppers, eggplants, hot peppers, all sorts of different things. And I kind of like to switch it up and just to see what likes it the best. And that's what kind of gets us through the summer. And then it's basically about a 6-month cycle where I'll grow the greens from about October to May. And then from May to October, November or so, we'll have hot weather crops in there.
Okay. And then are you starting the seeds out in the fields directly? Or are you starting seeds inside the greenhouse and then transplanting them?
We transplant a lot of our more sensitive crops, or the ones that take longer, like peppers and onions are one that can always take a very long time to get to a transplant stage, as it's called, tomatoes as well. And those things also are ones that do better as a transplant by giving them a head start because of the variance in temperature that we have this time of year. So they're not a real big fan of cold nights, so we try to protect them as much as we can. And so those are really the main things that we transplant: the onions, peppers, tomatoes, eggplants, your what are called solanaceous vegetables, or your nightshades, are something that we transplant a lot of. Everything else I've had pretty good success with just direct seed planting. Of course, I say that, and this year it's a little bit slower, but in the past couple of years, again, because of the stresses that can happen this time of year, a lot of times even if you transplant, the plant will go into a stress mode and just kind of stop growing until the season or the conditions become ideal. And I've had it where something I've seed planted transplanted 6 weeks ago and have now putting out was smaller than something that I seed planted 2 weeks ago, simply because the benefit of seed planting is the seed comes up when it's ready. So a lot of times, you know, in order to guarantee that your transplants are going to do well, you wait longer to put them out. Whereas with seeds, they'll grow when the conditions are right. And so there's a few times, that I've had, and actually it really started a lot of times with volunteers, or seeds that come up on their own in the field. And so that's also a good signal of if the volunteer lettuce is starting to come up, then it's okay to start planting lettuce outside, that kind
of
thing.
Right. So. Right. And speaking of seeds, where do you get your seeds, or do you collect seeds? Do you do any seed saving at all? Or?
Oh yeah, we do buy seeds, and then as well, I try to collect as much as I can. We've been pretty successful with that. We do a lot of isolation of our plants, because we plant so many varieties, we have a lot of things that can cross-pollinate with each other. Mm-hmm. And in order to keep the purity of seed, i.e. if I want to know that I'll get the same carrot next year as I got this year, we have what are called our pollination isolation stations, which essentially is a big box that has it's covered in frost cloth, and that prevents it's frost cloth is essentially a very light sheet that is made of a material that's thick enough that pollen can't get through it, or very little of it can get through. And so that lowers your risk of cross-pollinating. But it's something that the insects and your bees and things like that can still get up underneath the container to get in there and help pollinate the veg itself. And actually, it's another aspect for protection as well, because it protects the plant very well because it slightly shades it. It's protected from the wind. And every year I do it, the plants that are underneath that station are usually about twice as tall. The yield is twice as large as anything out in the field. And so that's another method of where protection is really the name of the game as far as shade or greenhouses in the winter and things like that. But so that really enables us to collect a lot of our seed. I try not to grow too much hybridized seed. Technically you can't plant a hybridized seed again the next year, but that technicality is mostly because hybridized seed is something that's been crossbred with its parent. And so it's something that when you plant a hybridized seed that you saved, there's no guarantee that what you plant will look or taste the same as it did before. It'll still come out, say, like a tomato. It just might be bigger than the one you planted last year, or a different color or something like that. So in the aspect of knowing what you're going to get, I try to go with open pollinated seeds. Open pollinated means that it is something that can cross-pollinate with another plant, and you can save those seeds, and it'll produce true next year. And so we do try to save quite a lot of seed. And that's another method as well, is not only saving the seed and purifying it, but then as well collecting it at the right time, and making sure the plant goes to full maturity, or the fruit goes to full maturity. And there's different methods for different types of plants as far as how to clean the seed and store it. It's a lot of fun for me, actually. I really enjoy that part. The winnowing and things like that it's something that's timeless. It's something that mankind has done since we started becoming agrarian in our societies. And it's something that really connects. I feel that connection whenever, you're out there winnowing your bean seeds and literally holding it up in the wind and letting the wind take the pods while the beans fall into your pot. And
right,
it's special.
Yeah.
And also in the case of, food security and something, it's something where seeds are expensive, and every year they get more expensive. In that case, in economic sense, it just makes total sense. Environmental as well, because the seeds that we get, while I try to order a lot of drought-tolerant seeds and such, any seed that I collect from those plants will be more acclimatized than their parents were to this area. And so the more I can collect seed and plant that seed and collect more from that variety and plant more, hopefully the more acclimated those plants will become to this area and the better they'll do. And it's something that, then they might start coming in earlier, with our warmer temperatures, or just different factors that they start to adjust. Or if some of them show signs of resistance to certain pests, you definitely want to save those seeds. Like I have flats in my greenhouse where something came in and decided to eat most of the flat but then it didn't touch a couple of plants. And so I'm curious as to why. And so right. what I'll do is I'll mark those plants very specifically and then save those seeds because they have some sort of a resistance to it. I'm not sure exactly what that is, but I'll take it. Right. You know, and so it's always something like that. You're always acclimating more to your specific area.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, we'll be right back after this break and continue our interview with Doug Smith of Townside Farm. Welcome back to Earth Matters. We're here today with our guest, Doug Smith of Townside Farm, talking about community-supported agriculture. And education is a big part of what you all do at Townside Farm. Doug, can you tell us a bit more about some of the programs that you have going with Aldo Leopold, the elementary schools?
Sure. Well, we have, I believe that education is really the that's how farming is going to work, is by teaching, you know, the younger folks. I still have vivid memories of my very first farm trip to a cow farm and pig farm, went back in Connecticut, and I will never forget the gigantic sow that I saw etched in my memory. And so it was something that when I started to farm for myself, it was something that where using that memory as a catalyst, it was something that I can be that person to someone else. You know, I could potentially create that same opportunity for someone else. And so that's pretty gratifying. I mean, something that, you know, while it may not directly seem like you're getting through, there's always an aspect of something that kids pick up on. And it's something that I really enjoy working with them. And so, yeah, we have the Leopold School to start with. They're an alternative high school here in town. They have a freshman orient or community orientation program where they have different groups of about 8 to 10 freshmen that go different places throughout town. And I had them one Friday a week for 4 weeks straight, where I had 10 kids of the freshman class come out with a chaperone. And it's amazing. I look forward to this time of year every year because it's amazing, you know, the expression, many hands making light work, because the stuff that we can accomplish in those 4 weeks is, you know, much more than I could accomplish on my own in those 4 weeks, and to really get a lot of major projects done in a very short period of time and very quickly. They usually come out for about 5 hours or so on that Friday, and they always help me. Every year they've helped me put up our shade structure, which is a pretty massive structure that we hang over one or two of our fields that usually have our cold crops in. So our lettuces, our brassicas, things like that like a little cooler temperature. And so it's a lot of teamwork to really help that come together. And then as well, they help me a lot of seeding out in the field with planting of, last year we did a lot of potatoes and garlic. They had them seed. This year we did a lot of melons and cucumbers, onions, things like that. And then I try to take them through a mini farming experience. So we start with a little infrastructure, a little education and building on the farm, literally. And then we go into some seeding of things, and then we'll go into some weeding of other plants. And then finally we do planting. We're actually putting in new plants. And so it's always exciting to see them really kind of looking forward to the planting part, you know. And I love it when I hear the F word, as I like to call it, fun, you know, fun. At the end of the day, like, wow, that was fun, you know, and it's like, oh, great, you know. And so that's something that I really enjoy, is when you can actually, especially too, when you're speaking and, you know, you have the heads turned and they actually, you know, eye contact, that kind of thing, when you actually, they're engaged. And every year these guys are always engaged fully, and I can't say enough good things about them. I really, really enjoy having them out there. And it's a different group every year. It's really a lot of fun, especially because I've been living in Silver about 10 years now. And so there's a lot of kids that I've seen grow up in town, and now to have them at the farm, and it's really inspiring to me to, you know, if nothing else, just do it for the kids, you know. And as well, we had an apprentice when you're after your freshman year. I'm not sure exactly if they do it all 3 years after that or if it's just for senior year, but they do have a singular apprenticeship program or internship program, where I had one student come every Friday for about, it was the second half of the year of her senior year. And since the first half of that segment was during the winter, what we did is sort of a role reversal, where we had her starts at the co-op, actually on the retail level, processing veg in their produce section and putting it out for retail sales and things like that to see that end. So when it leaves the farm, what happens to it on a retail level? And then she got to come to the farm and see how it's grown, you know, and then how we ship it and pack it and give it back to the co-op. And so that was something that I really enjoyed about that aspect, and I try to keep that going, is to give them a more rounded aspect of the real journey of the food throughout the entire process. And I really enjoy that. And I'm hoping that we can have, I've had one so far and it was a great success. She's actually helping out at the school again this year with their garden program and things. And so it's great when you can see that successfully work. And yeah, I mean, that's, those guys are great. And then we also have, during the fall, we have a lot of groups from the Montessori school come out, different age groups, usually about once a week. Sometimes it's, usually they rotate of different age groups. I have anywhere from the kindergarten kids who just come out to kind of experience the garden, play in it, which is a lot of fun, to, you know, you got your 7 to 9 year olds and then your 9 to 14 year olds, that kind of thing. And it's fantastic. I mean, the different age groups that come out and seeing the, you know, again, these folks that, again, have known throughout most of their lives, you know, growing up and seeing them mature and coming over to the farm and really learning about that. And, you know, how excited some of these guys get just to purely be outside and just, you know, and becomes quite the talk of the town when they go back to school as far as who got to do what at the farm on what time. And, you know, a lot of times, especially during the fall, we have harvestable things, you know, so the watermelons are always popular with the kids. It's always a lot of fun when during, you know, after the hot day out in the sun, we can go out and pick a watermelon together and go back and eat it, and they can get it directly from the field. And that's always a really popular thing.
And that, it seems so important that kids actually see the field that the food is grown in.
Absolutely.
Because so many kids just go to the grocery store and they say, oh, so watermelons grow in grocery stores, you know?
Absolutely.
So it seems super important to give the kids that hands-on experience for growing or picking, picking these foods. And you also have a snack program with the Healthy Kids, Healthy Communities program. What's that about?
Well, it's great. So we have, you know, the two programs that I just mentioned are through the sort of alternative school structures in the town. The traditional schools actually have their own programs that are more grant driven, that are coming in, that Healthy Kids, Healthy Communities has been working with them, I think about 3 years now that we've done it, where we actually will have, they have a school snack program, number one, where we get, you know, they ask around to different farmers and different producers of who might think they could produce what come September when school comes back in. And we give them a general guesstimate of what hopefully will come in. And around September, there's a different school that's picked every year that will actually have a snack of, I think last year it was carrots, cucumbers, some lettuce and tomato as a salad. And then that rotates, I believe last year, where did it go? Went to Bayard, I believe. And the year before that, I went to the Stout Elementary. And so that changes around. So that's good to give the kids a different opportunity. And it occurs multiple days during, you know, 1 week. But I'll take what I can get as far as getting them exposure and, and things like that. A bigger benefit as well, I feel, again, is getting them more direct contact, which is also something that the Healthy Kids, Healthy Communities does as well. They'll pick a group from, again, a different school every year that will come out. About last year, we had 30 kids out there, and they were, I believe they were in third grade. But again, where we got to, I gave them kind of a general tour of the farm, and then we actually got to go out and pick some vegetables. We had, you know, picking cucumbers right off the vine and passing them around. We had some gigantic carrots that happened to be left in one of the fields. So that was kind of funny to go and, you know, pull a foot long, 4 inch wide carrot out of the ground, you know, the size of some of their arms kind of thing. And, you know, and the collective wow that came out of their mouths was totally worth it. It was amazing. And so, you know, we got a lot of pictures. It was actually on the front page of the paper a few weeks ago of their trip to the farm last year. And that's great. Again, just any exposure I can get to these kids. And it's really gratifying too. I mean, I will say, for, you know, a place that might be lacking in its farms, it has a lot of gardens. I will say, you know, every year whenever I have kids over, I always ask, the first question I ask is, who's got a garden at home? And almost every time, almost all of them raise their hands. It's really impressive. I will say that.
That's,
I mean, it's something that I think there seems to be this, and I think that's really a lot of where the future lies, is in backyards.
Backyard,
you know,
gardening.
And that's something that I really emphasize a lot at Townside as well, is I know full well that I'm not going to be feeding the masses. I feed who I can. But I like to feed people with knowledge as well. And I think that's even more powerful than the food itself, because I feel like I can empower people. I like to set an example of saying, you know, that we can grow as much as possible in a small space without having to expand. And how much, in continually every year, I'm like, how much more you know, sustainably though, you know, how much more can I grow in this space? You know, if I have a spare square of space, I'm like, all right, I want to fill that in with some perennials or a different type of crop. Or, you know, I got a lot of oohs and ahs basically if I can't, you know, at the farmer's market, if I can't believe all of this comes off of that little space, you know, and it's something that I really strive for. You mentioned before biodynamic and biointensive. I do grow in a biointensive method, which is basically a, on the back of a seed packet, you usually see something where you plant, say, lettuce 8 inches apart between heads and, say, a foot apart between rows. And what that is meant for cultivation or weeding and for machinery and things. And on the farm that I was trained on back east, we use a lot of machinery to cultivate because we're so large. And so in that way, it makes a lot of sense because you can run a machine through a field and weed it very quickly without disturbing the plants. But it's also there's a lot of space left over.
Right.
And here, especially with evaporation concerns and, you know, heats and water concerns, I want to try to actually fill the bed with as much veg as possible. And that way it suppresses weeds. So there's less weeding you actually have to do. And as well, if you fill the bed, it shades the bed and therefore can conserve the amount of water that might evaporate because it's not exposed to the sun. And so that's a really great method for us to use, and it's pretty successful. We also do a lot of companion planting, like I do beans with my squashes and melons. We grew corn a few years ago. I would also have that with beans and squash. We have herb beds. You know, I'll be, you know, growing some herbs underneath our fruit trees once they get big enough and things like that. So trying to really maximize the space and opportunity that we have to grow before we ever choose to expand, if that ever were to come to the case.
Yes, education is just so important, and you know, it's a good sort of segue to the future of farming. And I'm just wondering what your thoughts are in terms of where we're going. Do you think CSAs are, we're going to see more CSAs out there? I mean, we've sort of seen the family farms being broken up and more industrial sized farms, but as you mentioned earlier, that now we're seeing younger farmers get out there, and mm-hmm. I just wonder, you know, what do you see this industry turning into?
I think it's somewhat, well, there's a lot of return to the smaller aspect, a lot of return to the, or at least I feel like a lot of return, especially around here, and questions that I get asked from people is, you know, again, that backyard gardening. And before I actually got into the full-time farming, that's what I used to do for folks, was install a food garden for them in their backyard and give them the right tools and setting up an infrastructure for them that they could plant whatever they wanted to. And it's, you know, it's something that I think is really the key, is self-empowerment, is knowing that, you know, less dependence on someone else and more empowerment of ourselves. And it really, you know, I can't stress enough, it doesn't take a lot of room and it really doesn't take too much effort, relatively speaking, like farming does, but a backyard garden, a couple hours a week, you know, and you can not necessarily, you might feed your entire, you know, vegetable needs throughout the year, depending on how much you really want to get into it. But I even get people just start with a tomato plant, start with an herb, a basil. You know, I think a lot of people are intimidated by the aspect of gardening or farming, and it's something that, you know, just do as much as you enjoy. You know, do as much as you can. And it's something that can really then evolve into something greater. But, you know, start small and expand as you grow. I mean, when I first moved here, I grew on windowsills. You know, right. I had literally just some planting boxes on a windowsill because it was something. You know, I knew I couldn't have a garden, but I could have a little pot with a 2-foot corn plant in it, you know?
You probably heard this statistic that during World War II, Victory Gardens grew 40% of the produce in this country.
Sure.
So pretty impressive. We've done it before. We can do it again. And what about the future of CSAs? Do you think that we're going to have more reliance on CSAs in the future as we go forward?
I think CSA works as a great business model in general. I think it can work and has been proven to work in other models, not just food. I've seen it work in microbrewing operations as far as beer is concerned.
Right.
That's also another industry that's rising back up. And in a lot of, you know, retail aspects, or, you know, it works a lot with things of value-added products and things like that, that can really, you know, if you can find enough people that are willing to invest initially, and then that return on their investment being, you know, either a food product or a preserve or something like that. I mean, obviously, with farms and things, it seems to make the most sense, but there are, I've seen and read about adjustments in just the business world in general of how it can really benefit, again, in that community aspect, especially in that, you know, keeping your money in the local economy, that's really where it's key. And I think, you know, as far as the future of the farm is concerned, I mean, it's really a lot of, I'm in the mood to get a lot of protection. I'd like to be able to have our growing season become longer with less stress on the land and less stress on the well. You know, growing perennial food crops, growing in greenhouses, more protection. There's a method of rolling greenhouses that you can employ that will essentially, so you can move the entire greenhouse over a crop. And then when that crop doesn't need that protection anymore, you can move it over another crop that would. And that in turn, again, can extend your rotations as well as your season. It's pretty amazing stuff.
Well, great. Doug, thanks so much for joining us today. How can people get a hold of you?
Well, right now I am at the farmers markets currently on Saturday, so you can find me downtown, and I have plenty of information there. We do have a website or a blog spot. It is townsidefarm@blogspot.com. We also have an email address, townsidefarm@gmail.com. And those are three are pretty much our biggest ways. And plus, it's a small town. I mean, you can always find me around. If they happen to be in town and want to inquire about the CSA, there's folks at the co-op here in town that know all about it. And but otherwise, yeah, I would say those two, email and the farmers market, are probably the easiest ways to get in touch. And the website also has more information on the CSA and how that works.
Well, great. I'm looking forward to a very tasty season. I'm a member of your CSA, so I'm looking forward to it. All right. We hope you'll tune in again for next week's edition of Earth Matters here on Gila Membrus Community Radio.